Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Why Am I So Happy? Paul Levee here. I am so happy today to share with you such an amazing gentleman. I have with us today James Strait. And I'll just give you a quick review about James, and then we'll have him share much more discussion on his amazing background. James was raised in rural Missouri during the 50s and 60s, joined the U.S. Army right out of high school, became the youngest graduate of Special Forces Training Group. After the military, he became a professional pilot, flying over 100 different makes and models, categories, and types of airplanes. He also accumulated 3,000 skydives. It's also exciting. He was the owner and operator of two small businesses. He became a talk show host, radio, and then he became an author. He has published several books and novels, which we will have him share with us. First off, James, I want to give you a big welcome and tell you how honored I am to have you on the show today.
Well, thanks, Paula. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, so happy to have you here. I would love you to begin with sharing a little more about your background with us. I'm really excited to hear what it was like as a young man to be in our military special forces.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story, especially for me, because I grew up in rural Missouri during the 50s and 60s. And one of the aspects of teenage life was going to drive-ins. Now, back in 1966, I guess it was, late 66, the number one popular song in the country was Ballad of the Green Beret, sung by Sergeant Barry Sadler, who was just an ordinary military special forces operator, who probably at the behest of the military developed this song, Ballad of the Green Berets. And I had listened to it multiple times, and as unlikely as it was at the time, it was the number one song in the country. Now, coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, a movie came out called The Born Losers, and it was one of those motorcycle movies that was popular back in that era, where the outlaw gangs would come into the town, and there was always one good guy who somehow defeated the outlaw bikers. And in that movie, there was a hero named Billy Jack, and it went on to become a series of movies. I think he ultimately made four movies. And Billy Jack was an ex-Green Beret who was the good guy who defeated the bikers. Now, I'm a 17-year-old kid who had been brought up in a very patriotic family, and I was accustomed to listening to the Ballad of the Green Berets. I went to see this movie in a drive-in called Born Losers, and Billy Jack took care of the bad outlaw bikers. And mm-hmm. I was just getting out of high school, and the Vietnam was at its, you know, starting to ramp up, and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to become a Green Beret. So I went down to the recruiter, and I said, how do I become a Green Beret? And he said, well, this is what happens. And fortunately, even at 17 years of age, I was smart enough to get everything in writing, to get a written guarantee from the recruiter that I could become a Green Beret, provided I met all the requirements.
Yes.
And that's what happened. I signed up, and reluctantly, my mother and father, because I was still younger than is required, and they had to get parental parents permission to go in the military, they signed the papers, and off I went. And you actually, at the time, had to be 18 years, 3 months of age to enter Special Forces training. So I had to go through basic training and some little advanced training. And then I waited for about 6 or 8 weeks to actually enter Special Forces training. And prior to that, you have to take multiple examinations, which I passed all of those. And then I went in as, you know, a really young kid. I didn't really fully understand how naive and how young I was when I went into it. But, you know, for my frame of reference right then, all I wanted to do was do whatever it took to become a Green Beret. And, you know, 6 months later, I had graduated Special Forces Training Group and had, at the time, was the youngest guy to ever graduate Special Forces Training Group. And I would imagine if I'm still not the youngest, I've got to be very close to the youngest to ever accomplish that. So that's my only real claim to military fame.
Ah, I love it. I love it. Oh, I am so passionate about our military. My father's a vet, my husband. I love fundraisers. That is just a great story. That had to be an amazing time in your life. How long were you in the service?
3 years.
3 years. I love it. I love it. And from there, James, you became a professional pilot. I would love to hear about that. I always felt that had to be so fascinating. Was becoming a pilot what you thought it would be?
It was and it wasn't. I grew up next to a small grass airstrip in rural Missouri. And so even though I had no real connection with the airport, it literally the runway butted up adjacent to our property. So I could go out by the barn and lean into the fence and just watch airplanes come taxi down towards me, turn around and take off. And then when they take off, I'd be bathed. It was, you know, typically all warm, typically in the warm weather months. And I'd be bathed in the warmth of the prop blast and the smell of the gasoline or the kerosene or whatever happened to be propelling the airplane. And those were my childhood images. And then when I went in the military, of course, I started jumping out of, you know, large military aircraft and riding in all manner of helicopter and jumping out of those. And it was just something that, you know, really cemented my passion for aviation. And though I didn't fly airplanes in the military, as soon as I got out, I continued with the jumping, becoming an active skydiver, and as a function of being around skydiving, I started flying airplanes, and over a period of a couple of years, I acquired all the ratings required to fly just about anything. And from that point forward, it was just a matter of meeting people, and what you would call networking now was just meeting people in the aviation community who met me and liked me and then opened doors for me, and the next thing I knew, 10 years later, I was flying jet airplanes.
Wow. Yes. Now, with flying the airplanes, I would imagine that's you travel so many places. You probably are. It's a lot of hours. I mean, is that? Would you say it's very different than, let's say, someone's 9-to-5 job?
Oh yeah, it's a lot different than a 9-to-5 job. It's in many ways. A lot of the work hours are hidden. You don't. The average person wouldn't appreciate the amount of work that goes into becoming and maintaining, you know, the status of a professional pilot. And you're right. There is a lot of travel involved, which, on the surface, in the beginning, sounds romantic and exciting. But after, you know, 15 years of checking in out of hotels, it gets pretty old.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you eventually retire from that process, the mechanics of, you know, just dealing with the logistics of it, you don't miss that. But, you know, the airplanes itself, yeah, that's a thing that I think that I'll probably miss. I mean, I don't fly much anymore. I haven't for about 10 years. And I do, at one level, miss that, but I don't miss the logistics of it, you know, the checking in out of hotels and all the complications that are associated with the, you know, the ground transport, that type of thing. But as far as just the aviation aspect of it, yeah, it's different than a 9-to-5 job, but it's also very interesting. I was talking to my son, who is now also a professional pilot, and he had just visited us last week for about a week, and we were talking about how his career has progressed, and he's been a flyer now for 15 years, and we were talking about how for me and for him too, the checking in out of hotels is just takes away from the magic of the flying. But on the other hand, you're not out in the cold shoveling, you know, dirt to dig ditches or something. You're either in a warm cockpit or in a cool cockpit, and you're typically taking the airplane somewhere nice. Yes. So you have the advantage of having the travel that takes you to nice places, and the type of flying I did, which was flying for private individuals who had enough money to own their own private jets. We would typically go someplace for a week or so and stay there. And for me, it was kind of like a mini vacation at their expense. And as I looked back across, especially the last half of my flying career, I averaged working about 8 days a month. So it's not a bad way to make a living.
Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of your flying career was for like private jets. And so you would take them to this place, this venue of their vacation, and then you would just hang out there until it was time to fly back?
That was pretty much what we did.
You know, oh my gosh. That is fascinating.
I spent probably, I'm going to say at least 50% of my career in the Caribbean. And I'd been to 90% of the islands in the Caribbean. And typically we would go there for a week, sometimes two, sometimes 3 weeks. And more irony in my life, I'm not particularly an island guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the islands when I like an island when I first go to it because it's new. And they're all beautiful to fly into and fly out of. And there's the visual aspect of it. But once I've been on an island for about 2 days, I'm ready for the next island. So there were times when I'd get kind of claustrophobic on the island, but then mm-hmm. I'd also have to keep things in perspective. You know, I was on an island, a place that many people would, you know, or they did pay thousands of dollars to go to and spend a week or two there, and I was doing it out of somebody else's pocket. So it was not a bad deal.
Yeah, fascinating. And I'm curious with that, James, because I was thinking, let's say you worked for Alaska and you're just given this schedule. Well, with what you were doing there, is it that, okay, you're out there as this type of pilot and then you become a client for different people? They're like, have you on their list when they want to go somewhere? They just give you a call and schedule you out?
Well, there were instances where that happened. If we were somewhere for 3 weeks, sometimes we would hire the plane out while the owner of the airplane was lounging on the beach or on a yacht or whatever he was doing. We would take the airplane somewhere else and fly people somewhere else. But that didn't happen a lot, but yeah, it did happen.
Yes, yes. Oh, that is just so fun. So fun. I'm going to want to discuss all of your skydiving. It sounds absolutely fantastic. We just have a couple minutes for break, but I would like to ask, so at the time you were doing your professional pilot work, were you doing skydiving then as well, or did it come after?
No, I did it before I became a professional pilot. I did it when I was a professional pilot, and I did it a little bit after I was a professional pilot. So it was an ongoing process.
Yes, yes. I love it. I love it. Well, let's go ahead and pop into a break, and when we come back, we'll have you share some of that, you know, experience and what that was like with all that skydiving. I'm fascinated by that. So everyone, James and I will be right back. Thank you, James.
Sure.
Hello, everyone. This is Paula Vale, founder of Wellness Inspired and host of the Why Am I So Happy show on VBS Radio. My passion is sharing the beautiful healing modality of Reiki with the world. I help you reach a new level of self-awareness and create a more confident and empowered version of yourself. Learn how Reiki will change your life. Go to wellnessinspired.com. When you live a life with love and compassion, you allow your blessings to manifest. Check out my Reiki training and Reiki practitioner mentoring program. And look for my soon-to-be-released ebook, Why Am I So Happy? At wellnessinspired.com and the paulavnetwork.com. Big hugs to everyone. Paula V. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Paula V here with James Strait. If you are just joining us, we were just talking about his background and the fascinating history that James has. James actually, while being a professional pilot, he also did a lot of skydiving. And I understand, James, that you have 3,000 plus skydives in your history. Please share with us what triggered you to want to skydive, and you obviously loved it. And for people like myself, listeners that have never experienced that, I would love to hear about that.
Yeah, well, it kind of all connects back to my early childhood experiences in rural Missouri, where I grew up next to a grass strip airport. And though no parachuting took place at that airport, there was an airport about 30 or 40 miles from our house where, unbeknownst to me as a real young kid, really early skydivers were making jumps at the airport. And I remember one afternoon we had just left church, and typically after church we would go for a Sunday drive through the countryside. And I had fallen asleep on the back of the rear seat. I think I was probably about 10 years of age at the time. And I woke up just as we drove past an airport called Gumbo Airport. And looking out through the side window, here came a man down under an orange and white round parachute. And mm-hmm. I sat up and I watched him descend and watched him land. And I just remember being extremely fascinated by it. And then nothing parachute related entered my mind until 7 or 8 years later when I went into the military and I had to jump out of airplanes to become a Green Beret. And when I made my first jump, I was horrified. I was in the middle of a line of about 25 guys, and I was really glad of that because I didn't really have any choice. Once we started towards the door, the momentum just took me out. And once I was out of the airplane, I was bathed in the exhaust of the prop blast and the slipstream, and it was just the most amazing couple of seconds of my lifetime up to that point. And the next jump, my second jump, I couldn't wait to do it. And the first one, I was horrified. The second one, I couldn't wait to do it. So I jumped out of airplanes in the military just as a function of that's what you had to do to accomplish that mission. But I really enjoyed the process. So when I got out of the military, I immediately became a sports skydiver. And this was back in 1970 when I started skydiving. And skydiving then was still kind of sort of in its infancy, where in its infancy being described as the equipment that was being used was mainly military equipment that was adapted to the skydiving mission. And it was pretty crude and it didn't work that well, and it was and plus the skill sets were low, and the instruction wasn't as good as it is now, because just it was still everybody was suffering a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And but it allowed me to have a frame of reference about the act of skydiving from essentially witnessing it from its infancy on through the next 30 years, where it became where it is right now, pretty much just like a carnival ride. You pay your $200 and you go up and you make a jump, and it's not that much different than riding a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And but along the way, I met a lot of really interesting people who were instrumental in the development of the equipment that we're all familiar with now, the square parachutes and all the other supporting type structures that make things as safe as it is now. And as a function of that, I had also became a parachute rigger while in the military. And I had, while on leave, I had gone to the FAA near my home in Missouri and asked to take the senior rigger parachute exam. And I got my senior rigger's ticket, which is a civilian certificate. And that allowed me to start getting involved in the design and production and manufacture and development of parachute systems. So I ultimately had a couple of small companies that did prototype work, where I would design and develop prototypes for different companies, and including the military occasionally. And I would have test programs and just take that stuff all through the process to get it to the point where it was usable, or to the point where it could be manufactured. And so in addition to making all the jumps, which was just a function of, you know, liking what I did,
yes.
I got involved into design and manufacture on the, mainly the prototype level and the skydiving world. So it was an adjunct to my life that my children grew up In fact, I can remember my oldest daughter. She was about 7 or 8 years old. And my two younger kids were probably 6 and 4 or 5, something like that. And one day they realized that I was talking to somebody that wasn't a pilot or a skydiver. And up to that point, they had pretty much assumed that everybody else in the world was also a pilot or a skydiver.
I love it.
That's how ubiquitous it was in our life at the time. But no, skydiving is, you know, it's not for everybody. But for me, it worked. It enriched my life. At times, I look back at it, and I think it took too much time out of my life. There were things I should have probably done that weren't so repetitive. You know, I was just repeating an experience that I'd already experienced before, but I liked it a lot, so I just kept doing it. Kind of like a minor addiction.
Yes.
But, you know, it enhanced my life, and it actually made me some money. So I guess I can't look back at it and think anything but positive thoughts about it.
Yes, I love it. Now, with your skydiving, did you pretty much jump in the same area all the time, or did you ever travel to other areas and skydive there to experience that?
No, there was a period when, and like from like 1972, 73, something like that, where I owned a Volkswagen pop-up van, and I drove all across the United States skydiving at different places.
Oh my gosh, that had to be so fascinating.
Yeah, it was a great time. I met my wife that way. My wife was a skydiver. She stopped when we got married, but she does like 300 jumps. And so I met my wife skydiving, and I travel quite a bit skydiving.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So, James, tell me, you know, what brought you to transition? What triggered you to later become a talk radio host?
Well, when I was in my middle 50s, I had a stroke, and I was still flying at the time, but I know it was a minor stroke. I didn't suffer any physical deficit. I did have a little bit of a mental hiccup where I couldn't pronounce several polysyllabic words, which had I tried to say the word polysyllabic back then, it wouldn't have worked. And there were some words that I couldn't spell, which was frustrating when I played Scrabble. And that deficit lasted about a year or so, but it was enough for me to take myself out of the cockpit. I could have passed my flight physical. I could have, you know, legally gone up and flown airplanes, but I knew that I shouldn't do it. So I essentially just voluntarily retired. And when I retired, there was a hole in my life, and several people knew that, and they said, you know, they were trying to be helpful to me, and you know, talking, what are you going to do with the rest of your life, because you still have, you know, 25, 30 years to live probably. And I said, well, I'm not sure, but I'd always liked talk radio. And I said, I think maybe I'll look into becoming a radio host. And they all kind of looked at me like, how are you going to do that? I mean, you're 56 years old. How are you going to go into talk radio? And the way I did it was I essentially purchased the time of an established radio host. He became my mentor. And I did buy his time. And so, but I looked at it as an investment. So we met for lunch one day. I called him up and I said, this is what I want to do with my life, the rest of my life. And he thought it was interesting that I would do that, that I would actually call him up or to call any radio host up and present the idea. So we met for lunch and we had about a 2-hour lunch and we kind of clicked. And the next thing I knew, I spent 6 months going into the radio station and you know, watching him do what he did and watching the engineers do what they did. And he gave me some on-air time. And then when he thought I was ready, he said, well, I'm going to introduce you to somebody. So he introduced me to a station owner, and I wound up getting my own show, an hour-long show. And I had that show called Straight Talks for 6 years, and it was mainly just general topics we talked about. And I did what most radio hosts do of that genre of radio show that, you know, you talk to politicians, and you talk to, you know, famous movie stars, and you talk to, you know, people who have somehow become notable in the news. And that was all interesting for me for about 6 months. And then after you interview your, you know, 50th politician, and you've gone through the same frustrating process of them not answering the question that you ask, then you start thinking, well, who do I really want to talk to? Who's going to be really interesting to me? Who's going to be beneficial to the listener? Yes. And I wound up talking to authors. And because authors are people who are curious about whatever topic they're writing about, they're more than eager to tell you about not only themselves, but about the topic and how they acquired information about a topic. Or maybe it's something that was their life and they wrote about something they didn't really have to research. They just wrote about what they knew. But they are always honest. And you, when you ask the question, not only did you get the answer you're looking for, you got a prolific answer. And so I really enjoyed talking to authors as having them as on-air guests. And I ultimately ran into the two guys who started the Weird Title series of books. They started with Weird New Jersey. And at the time, they were up to about 20 states. And since I was from Missouri, and since we clicked on air, we started exchanging emails. They were looking for somebody to write about Missouri, to do the title Weird Missouri. And so they hired me to write the book. It was my first book. They asked me to send in a sample of my writing, which they submitted to the publisher. And the publisher said, okay, we think this guy can write the book. So they hired me, and I went out to Missouri for 8 weeks, and I hadn't been back to Missouri for years. And I drove 8,500 miles to go to every nook and cranny of the state. I went to about 300 different venues and interviewed hundreds of Missourians, took 2,700 pictures. And then I came back home and sat down for 4 months and wrote Weird Missouri. And that was my first book, and that's how I got introduced to becoming an author.
Oh, that is so fascinating. So that was basically connecting with them, and then you took on the Missouri Challenge. I love it.
I did, yeah. It's all about connectivity.
Yes, yes. It's so fascinating, the people we meet and the people we connect with. And you actually did your radio show, what, about 6 years, didn't you?
Yeah, I had it for 6 years, yeah.
Wow, that's a great show. Is there any particular guest or show, any funny story that you'd like to share from that?
Funny stories. There's probably several funny stories. Author-wise, I met a fellow on the air, and I actually wound up meeting him 2 or 3 years later in person. But he is I say it's funny. I think it's as much amazing as it is funny, but if I can describe it visually, it might have more appreciation for your listeners, because basically, my mother died about 6 years ago, and we all took her back to Missouri to bury her next to my father. And on our way to the cemetery, when we were going to bury her, we were about an hour early. It was very hot that day. My entire family was with me. And we stopped at the equivalent of a 7-Eleven convenience store just to get some bottled water to drink while we were waiting for the whole procession to arrive at the cemetery. And when I got out of the car to get the water, there was a adult-sized bicycle parked in front of the store, and it had a really large American flag and a large POW flag suspended above it on poles. And it had banners all around it talking about this guy's world travels, about how many times he'd crossed the international dateline in 747s and on and on and on. And I looked at it for a second. I thought, well, this is an interesting character, whoever has this, because the basket behind the seat was filled with tin cans. He went around collecting tin cans to recycle. So I went in, and I got the water, and then I asked the clerk, I said, do you know who belongs to that tricycle out front? Because I was, at that moment in time, I was in the process of just beginning the research for doing Weird Missouri. And they said, oh, that's Catfish George. I said, okay. I said, can you point him out to me? He said, well, we don't know where he is. He spends a lot of time around here. So basically, I left my card, and I said, I'll be back in a week or so, and I'd like to maybe link up with this guy, so could you please give him my card and explain to him that I'm an author writing about Missouri, and I'd like to talk to him. So a week later, I'm back, and sure enough, Catfish George is there waiting for me, and he didn't know what time of day I was going to be there. He was just there waiting for me, and he had a couple of photo albums that he wanted to share with me, and he was very skeptical, I think, you know, he was excited but skeptical at the same time, because mm-hmm. he just didn't understand what was about to transpire. And He was a ex-Marine who had spent his life as a $10 an hour welder. And I mention the $10 an hour because it's really important for the story, because he is probably one of the most well-traveled guys I've ever met. And he didn't start traveling until he was in his early 50s. And when I met him, he was just, I think he was maybe a couple, 3 months from his 70th birthday. And what makes him, well, funny, he's funny if you just look at him superficially, because he dresses head to toe in black clothing, has this real droopy black hat that he wears with all kinds of pins from all the travels he's done over the world. And he has a black leather vest also covered in pins and sew on patches from places that he's been. And, but when you hear about his life, that he grew up, I mean, dirt poor in deep rural Missouri in the hollows of the Ozark Mountains. And he grew up in a wood cabin where the openings between the logs were stuffed with newspaper. And he remembers in his bedroom, one front page was about a picture of the Alps. And as a kid, he always wondered, how do you get to the Alps? How does anybody ever get to the Alps unless you're born there?
Yes.
And that thought was with him for 25 years, 30 years. And he never thought about traveling because he just didn't think he could afford it. He made $10 an hour. And then about 20 years ago, he learned about train passes in Europe. And he looked at how much money he had saved, and he'd always been extremely frugal. And this guy who has this massively deep baritone voice, it sounds like it's coming from out of a barrel, and just his normal volume dominates a room, but who is also an extremely modest guy, looks at his bank account and says, I think I can go to Europe. So he goes to Europe, he gets on an airplane ticket, goes to Europe, gets a rail pass, goes to about 7 or 8 countries, comes back with the addiction to travel. Now, this guy has been to about 70 countries when I haven't talked to him for 2 or 3 years, but he'd been to 7 or 8 countries or more when I spoke to him last. And he has sent me, we haven't corresponded in the last couple of years, so it kind of makes me concerned about what his condition may be. But I've got in a box, I've got a couple hundred letters from him, and he'll send me letters from wherever he goes. And he's been to Australia. He loves Australia. He's been to Australia 18 or 19 times. And he's been to North Korea twice. Not many people go there as, you know, a pleasure trip. And he's been to multiple countries multiple times. And he does this on $10 an hour. And I've told him, I said, man, you should be in charge of America's economy, because I have no idea how you can afford to do this. Mm-hmm. But he travels on the cheap. He doesn't go to hotels. If he lives large when he travels, he'll stay in a hostel or some kind of a bed and breakfast that's, you know, a very low-end bed and breakfast. He sleeps on the side of the road. He travels in his welder's uniform. So here's a guy who has prioritized his life. It's more important for him to see the world than it is to see the world in a fashion that most people want to do it. They want to go to a 4 or 5 star hotel.
Yes.
He doesn't care about it. He just wants to go to another country. So you say something, you asked for a funny story. It's funny in the sense that it's just so unusual that here's a guy who can place things in a priority that makes him happy, brings him happiness, and impresses me like very few people in my lifetime. Yeah. He's just this amazing guy. So I've met many people on air that have left lasting impressions with me, but I think Catfish George is maybe one of the more impressive, and he got his name because he loves to catfish when he's not traveling.
Oh, fascinating. What a fascinating man. I love that. Thank you for sharing, James.
Sure.
Oh, well, gosh. Well, we are going to pop out for another break. But everyone, James and I will be right back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for staying with us. And I know you're enjoying James Strait as much as I am. Oh, I could just chat with you for hours, James. I am loving this. You are just fascinating and inspiring. I would love to know.
Can you tell that to my wife?
Yes. That's right. You tell her to listen to the show. There we go. I love it.
And my wife of 38 years.
I love it. I love it. And with that, I am going to share with everyone something that just touched my heart. I absolutely loved that I saw in your information, something you say is, I'll die a success because of my family. The rest is just resume stuff. That is so beautiful, James. That just says it all. It really does.
Yeah, thank you.
The people we have in our lives. I would love for you to take this segment and share with the listeners information about your various books. Tell us what you have going on in the future. So just which book would you like to touch on to begin with, James?
Well, even though we touched on it briefly in the previous segment, I think, you know, I'll start at the beginning with Weird Missouri, because Weird Missouri is a book that's part of a series. So I kind of was very fortunate to run into the two gentlemen that hired me to write Weird Missouri, because they already had an established winning genre of books. And they also had a television program that was speaking about America at large, Weird America. And so to be invited to write Weird Missouri as my first book was, I think, you know, a really good piece of good fortune. And but it did allow me to begin to fully appreciate the process of writing a book. Now, writing for me is actually pretty easy, because up to this point, I've written about things that I know. I've had to do very little research for any novel that I've written. Now, Weird Missouri was research intensive. I spent 8 weeks in Missouri doing the research and, you know, interviewing people and going to, you know, hundreds of fascinating places that, even though I grew up in Missouri, I had very little familiarity with. So it was an education in that sense, that to learn Missouri as intimately as I did. But it also gave me a real appreciation for the mechanics of preparing to write a book, and, you know, the process itself, and, you know, the editing and the re-editing and the writing and the rewriting. And as I wrote Weird Missouri, which took 4 months, but it's a book that has as many pictures in it as it does words. So I didn't have to write that many words. Weird Missouri has about 30,000 words in it, maybe 35,000. And the average 300-page novel is somewhere between 90 and 100,000 words. So my first novel after Weird Missouri, which I waited about a year to write another book after Weird Missouri, was a book about the upcoming 12/21/2012 phenomenon, where everybody thought the world was going to come to an end.
Yes.
So I wrote a book called Weird Missouri in the mind. The novel that I wrote first was Deja Vu All Over Again. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially just a story of the approaching date of 12/21/2012 and one possible scenario that might explain that particular moment if it were to be reality, which, you know, it obviously wasn't and it couldn't be. But it was something that at the time, if you think back, a lot of people were talking about it, and it was a nightly news story for weeks, you know, ahead of time. And then when the day finally came and nothing changed, and then we all knew that that date was just the thing that was on the Mayan calendar that became fascinating for people. But for me at the time, it was the impetus for me to engage my creative process and to invent a story that was meaningful on levels beyond just the story itself. Because what I thought as I wrote a novel, if I can't share some of what I've learned in life, if I can't, not to be pretentious, but to share some wisdom that I've acquired over the ages and incorporate mm-hmm. that into the story, so as the reader reads, they say, well, okay, yeah, that's something I should think about too, then I've wasted an opportunity in writing the book. And that book took me 4 months to write. It was about 95,000 words. And being my first book and not being a really well-known author, it didn't sell as well as I had hoped, but it did okay. And then I waited about another year, and I wrote a book that became a little more topical, because we've all spent the last 15 years immersed in the global war on terror. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a book called World War III, Not How You Imagined. And it's a book that's expansive. It's about 130,000 words, 100 and something pages. But it's just another story that's action-adventure. It's a fast read because I learned in the first novel that if you want people to read your books consistently, they need to be page-turners, so you can't have null spaces. So I think each chapter is fairly short, and it leaves you wanting to go to the next chapter to see what's happened to the character who's just involved in a previous chapter. And, it is a war story, and it's a war story set in modern times. It's a war story that would take place about a year from now, fictionally. But it again, was an opportunity for me to not only tell a story that was entertaining, but also an opportunity to share some of the things I've learned in life. And then I wrote a third novel that's called The Price of Contempt, When Islam Pushed Too Hard. And it, too, is a modern action-adventure war story predicated on the fact that we're still immersed in the global war on terror, which doesn't seem to want to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So those were my first four books. You know, that started with the Weird Missouri, which is a travel guide of sorts, because people can use it to go to different little places in Missouri for maybe like a weekend trip to see a couple of things that I explain in the book. And then the others are just light entertainment. Well, light, not necessarily light entertainment, but it's all fiction.
Yes.
So you take it with that kind of a frame of reference. But the book that I'm working on now is something that I have to do a lot of research for, because I mentioned before I didn't have to do much research for the others because it was my background. But the book I'm writing about now is about mankind's journey to Mars, which we will be doing in the next 15 years. And for that, I'm going to have to do a lot of research. I've already done a lot of research, and I'm also creating my own systems and ways to do things. And but the journey to Mars, I think, can be mankind's next really inspirational event, and it may be something that can, even if we're still involved in this ongoing war on terror, global war on terror, maybe a focus on something that's much larger than ourselves, something that seems almost impossible to do. The trip to Mars can be something where everybody around the world can use it to distract themselves from all the other things that go on in life. So this novel is probably going to be the longest novel that I have written, and certainly the most challenging because of the research involved and the fact that, as time goes by, technology changes, and the way you could do things change based upon existing technology, and technology you can see just over the threshold.
Yes.
And so I'm really, my head is kind of into this now, and I really can't share a lot of the story with you because mm-hmm. that would be inappropriate. But I can say that anybody writing about a journey to Mars, and if you look in Google, if you just Google books going to Mars, there have been hundreds of books written over the ages about going to Mars. And they typically come in two genres, two styles. Prior to the Mariner probes that went up in the 70s, they were all fantastical things that have, all kinds of wild stories about, oceans and canals and Martians and all that. And then there's the more modern books, which once we went to Mars, we sent a probe there, we had photographs of it, we started to understand what was on the surface and on the atmosphere. Then the books started to become a little more technical, a little more reality-based.
Yes.
And my book is going to be in the latter category. So
yes.
I don't think we're going to run into Martians, but we may run into other things.
Oh, this is, I'm really excited for that book. I'm really excited. And I'm really excited to read your other books. I'm really looking forward to that. Will you tell the listeners how they can order your books, James?
Yeah, all the books are available at all, really, literally any book seller online. But the most convenient and straightforward way to do it is just go to Amazon.com, and you can type in my name, James Strait, and that takes you to all four of my titles. Or you could type on the title, and that will take you there also. But Amazon.com is the most efficient way to do it.
I love it. I love it. James, we are down to about 4 minutes left in the show. What last words would you like to share with the listeners today?
Last words. Well, this is a show about happiness, and you're certainly
yes.
a happy host, that's
yes.
for sure.
Yeah.
And even though I have a sometimes a bit of a flat tone to my voice. I'm actually a very happy person, and I'm 67 years old now, and I've lived a life that's much longer than I ever expected. And I've seen and done things that I just really didn't, as a young kid growing up in Missouri, couldn't have imagined that my life could have taken me to there, and to actually do those things and see those things and go to the places I've gone and meet the people I've met. And, so I guess, you know, if I were to offer any advice or words of wisdom is to, you know, I mentioned the word connectivity a while back, and, you know, life is about connecting with other people. And in today's professional world, they call it networking. But prior to 20 years ago, I think, or 25 years ago, when networking became a viable term, it was just people meeting people. And, you know, in your professional life, in my professional life, I met people who opened doors for me. And I was always smart enough to walk through the door. And on a couple occasions, I walked through a door and I looked around and I didn't really like what I saw. And I just shook their hands and thanked them and went on. Other times, the door was open for me, and I walked in, I liked what I saw, and the next thing you know, I had been flying airplanes there for 10 years. So, you know, life is about connectivity, meeting people, being positive, and as you say, you know, being happy. There's two ways to go in life. You can be unhappy or happy. Why not be happy?
I love that. I love that. Personally, I believe happiness is a choice we make every day. Yes. Fantastic.
I'm in agreement with you.
And I love your analogy. You know, things can open up and we can go through that door and we can feel it's a fit, or we can feel, no, this doesn't resonate with me. And, you know, but yet we stay open to what may come in. I love that, James.
Yeah, and it's also important that if somebody's opened a door for you and it doesn't work out, you don't burn that bridge. You shake their hand, you thank them, and you keep them as an associate or a friend or just someone that you've met in your lifetime that you could go back to. Or if you've met them in a store, you could shake hands and have a nice conversation. You can always look somebody dead in the eye and feel good about it.
Yes, yes. Oh, I love that. Absolutely fantastic. I am just so honored to have you today, James. This has been just a fantastic show. I'm just thrilled.
Well, it's been an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Yes, we will stay connected. And I want to say a big thank you to all of my listeners out there. Love, hugs, blessings. Everyone have a happy day. James, happy day to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.